Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice-monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, why couldn't the pony sing in the choir?
Probably because he was a little hoarse.
You got it. Is that the first time you've guessed?
Yep. That might be the first time I got one.
All right, Paul. Well, thyroid surgery might come up on this episode, and, you know, hoarseness could be a problem there.
No, that's as close to relevant as you've been in quite some time. I'm really proud of you, actually.
I've had in years.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, maybe even the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Good. Well, we had two great guests tonight talking about thyroid nodules, thyroid cancer. Our guests were Dr. Kaniksha Desai and Dr. Anna Chindris, and they were wonderful guests. We were hooked up, Paul, by our good friends at the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, who, Paul, we've been working with them for 8 years now because we are old, and I guess our show is getting old as well.
Yeah, no, I won't disagree.
Okay. All right. Well, Paul, before we tell them about our two wonderful guests, can you remind the audience, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. As a reminder, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And Matt, would you like me to talk about our two guests?
Sure.
Otherwise, what are we doing, really? So we had a great conversation with Dr. Kaniksha Desai and Dr. Anna Chindris. Dr. Kaniksha Desai is a board-certified endocrinologist and clinical associate professor at Stanford University. She completed her endocrinology fellowship at the Mayo Clinic with an emphasis on the management of patients with thyroid cancer. Dr. Desai's clinical practice focuses on the management of patients with thyroid nodules and thyroid cancer. She also maintains board certification in neck ultrasonography. Dr. Anna Chindris has been a member of the Mayo Clinic Florida staff since 2014. She currently holds a joint appointment in the Department of Medicine, Division of Endocrinology, as well as Department of Cancer Biology. She is a treasurer of the Florida Endocrine Association, and her main areas of interest are thyroid neoplasia, and she is the current recipient of the George Haub Family Career Development Award in Cancer Research. Matt, on this episode, we go through what to do about those pesky thyroid nodules that we pick up incidentally, maybe even the ones that we happen to find on examination. What is the next step in the workup? What happens if it would turn out that something that requires finial aspiration or even further management, and sort of what kind of surveillance happens after someone might even have a diagnosis of thyroid cancer? And just to tease a little bit, I don't know if everyone else has been as panicked as I have about what to do with the GLP-1 agonist and someone with a vague history of thyroid cancer, but we get an amazing framework as to who we should worry about and who we can worry less about. So a really pearl-filled episode that I found extraordinarily helpful.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so yet, sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other stuff. patreon.com/curbsiders. Anna and Kaniksha, thank you so much for joining us on the show. The audience has heard your bios, but they need to know a little more about you. So, Anna, start with you first. Can you tell the audience a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine?
Yeah, I actually have many hobbies, but probably my oldest one is watching car racing, Formula One, which I have been since med school and through all these years. And more recently, I got the opportunity to actually go to a few races. I'm trying to go to one every year. So went to the first race that ever was held in Miami 3 years ago, and the last 2 years we went to Montreal because after the Miami heat, we got to go somewhere north. can't take that anymore. So that would be that. And more recently, I started growing Vanda orchids because Florida is a pretty good environment for that. And you don't have to do much for them to bloom. So that's about it.
I have to ask. We talked about before, like gardening. Our guests who garden just seem to be the most well-adjusted people. I've killed a couple of tomato plants, so whatever that says about me. But the Formula One racing, you started doing this in medical school. What were the circumstances? How did this happen? Was it just on TV, or did you have a friend that was very much into it?
Yes, it was on TV. So I grew up in Eastern Europe under the communism in 1990s. Right, the Iron Curtain fell, so we had more access to shows, including to sports. My younger brother was very much into cars, and that's how I picked it up through him. And then he kind of fell out of interest in terms of F1, but I stuck with it. And the very first race I actually attended was in Indianapolis in 2005. I was a resident in Michigan at that time, and so we wasn't that far from Detroit to go watch it. And it was I actually got to see Michael Schumacher racing, so he's a legend. I'm proud to have a couple pictures of him in the
this is amazing.
Yeah,
I love this so much.
I know it's a Netflix. There's some reality show with the drivers now, because my younger sister got into it and
Drive to Survive. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So they watched that. Okay. And that's cool. All right. Well, Kanikshya, we're going to ask you, because we want to get to the topic, but we're going to ask you about advice or feedback that you've received that you found meaningful and that you can share with the audience.
Sure. So a little bit about me. I trained on the East Coast and then moved over to Stanford in 2016. And I think the best two pieces of advice that I have for like trainees is that one, when you go around with attendings, just take the best of what everybody has to offer and then create your own style. So rather than copy just one person, a lot of people copy just their mentor. I think it's really great if you have many mentors and then you just take the good, because everybody has, some things they could do better. But if you could take the stuff that they do really good and then create your own style, I think that's really great. The second piece of advice that I got that I found really useful is that, keep an open mind about what's possible. Nothing is impossible. If you had asked me 15 years ago if I was going to be in California doing thyroid cancer and podcasting, I would have probably looked at you like you were crazy. So it's not what I had imagined. And I think a lot of people think medicine is a certain way when they go through medical school, when they go through residency. They have this expectation about what medicine is. And I think it can be a lot more if you just keep an open mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Paul knew he was going to be a podcaster, but that's...
Yeah, I mean, that was always... I went to medical school specifically so I could get into podcasting, so it worked out pretty great.
Right. And cats. Your cat will be here sure. any minute now. Did I just hear the cat, Paul? No?
That was not my cat, actually. I don't know what you heard.
All right. Paul's cat usually joins us for recordings. Basically the third co-host at this point, Holly.
Yeah. Had I known, I would have let my dog in here. I just closed the door on her.
Well, we're a cat show, Anna. I'm sorry, but...
I have a cat dog. I have a Shiba Inu, so they do behave like cats very much. All right.
That's fair. Well, Paul, how about we get to a case from CashLack? Because we have a lot to go through, and I'm excited to get into it.
Sure. So we're going to start with Mr. Ty Rad. Mr. Rad is a 68-year-old male with a history of high blood pressure and tobacco use who recently underwent low-dose CT for lung cancer screening. The results on the CT instantly note heterogeneity of the right lobe of the thyroid with multiple nodules. The patient is asymptomatic without any complaints at this time. You obtain a TSH, which results at 0.86, and get a thyroid ultrasound, which shows two right-sided lower pole thyroid nodules. They are both described as solid or almost completely solid, with sizes 3.8 by 2.3 by 2.2, so it sounds to me like a big boy, and then 1.8 by 1.3 by 1.1 centimeters, respectively. So we have this patient, this comes up all the time. We were talking before we hit the record button that with these low-dose lung cancer screenings, we see these abnormal thyroid nodules all the time now. So from here, Anna, where would we go? So what else will we ask in terms of the history, or what should we do in the physical examination as we start to kind of think about how we're going to work up this patient?
Right. Oh, well, first of all, I like your imagination with names, right? Mr. Tyrad, this is pretty cool. So he presents with an incidentally discovered thyroid nodule, or actually with a couple of them noted on unrelated imaging, right? So there were a couple of things that came to mind when you were presenting the case, and one you also pointed out at the end. Yes, we do nowadays see or get patients with thyroid nodules that are primarily diagnosed as incidental findings on unrelated imaging. So really, the clinical, every now and then we do see patients who were diagnosed through clinical exam, but this is by and large the majority, as incidental lomas, if you want. The other thing I wanted to also emphasize is that the thyroid nodules are very common, and patients are usually reassured to hear that. This is pretty much the first line I tell them, when they come with the complaint. So they are very common in the general population. The incidence increases with age, and the vast majority of them are benign. These are the three points that I tell them. But then, really, when we assess a newly diagnosed thyroid nodule, we try to answer two questions, right? The first question, is it a benign or a malignant thyroid nodule? The second question, does it cause any symptoms? Is it associated with any symptoms? So really, to answer your question specifically to this patient, I would ask Mr. Rad about his family history. Does he have any family history of thyroid cancer? I would ask him about personal history, any personal history of radiation exposure. And then I would ask him about any symptoms that could be attributed to these thyroid nodules, which, like you said, are fairly large. So any local symptoms. And in addition to that, because the TSH, although normal, is at the lower end of the normal range, and his thyroid nodules are large, as we talked about, I would also possibly ask him about any subtle symptoms of hyperthyroidism, because sometimes you can see fluctuation in the TSH and you can see very low, subclinical, if you want, or very low grade hyperthyroidism with the toxic nodule. So this is basically how I was thinking I would start with Mr. Rad. So for the physical exam, I would assess if the thyroid is mobile. So basically, if it moves with swallowing, as you would be expecting, if there are any palpable masses in the neck otherwise, or if there's any abnormal cervical lymphadenopathy. So this is pretty much where I would start with this guy.
Can I ask about the subtle thyroid symptoms? Paul, is that what you're going to ask, or something else?
I got other stuff, but yeah, I'd like to hear about those too. So
okay.
Let's go.
You said maybe
those.
The subtle symptoms of hyperthyroidism. I'm only capable of diagnosing not subtle hyperthyroidism. Can you tell us maybe we can get better?
Yeah, well, I had examples. I had a couple of patients in the clinic that really presented with, honestly, it was personality changes, okay? They were, the family reported they were more irritable. They, they were like snappier, if you want. Granted that the TSH in that particular person was lower, so it was clearly under the lower end of the normal range, but the T4 and T3 levels were still normal. So it was subclinical hyperthyroidism. But they did, we did discuss about the low-dose methimazole and with normalizing of her TSH, her personality improved.
Wow.
And this was based on her family's report as well. So that's occasionally what you see as a first, or at least in my experience, that's what I saw. Wow. Other patients can complain of palpitations. This is probably palpitations and heat intolerance are probably the next two two most common symptoms that are reported. But the reason I wanted to specify this is because we have, in this particular case, we have one TSH, one point in time, but the TSH can also fluctuate spontaneously in toxic nodules. So, if it's 0.8 now, it doesn't mean that it's not going to be 0.2, 3 months later, or it wasn't 0.2 4 months ago.
This episode is brought to you by Panacea Legal. Are you considering a new job or thinking about leaving your current role? A Panacea Legal attorney who specializes in physician contracts can review your agreement and help you understand if your compensation, call schedule, and exit clauses are fair and equitable. Panacea Legal offers a thorough review of your contract and a one-hour consultation with an experienced contract lawyer, plus access to an attorney for the following 12 months for follow-up questions. Here's what one physician had to say about their recent experience. Panacea Legal provided a clear, thorough review of my contract line by line. For someone like me, without a legal background, the contract felt overwhelming and the legal jargon was difficult to follow. Panacea Legal's attention to detail made a huge difference. Physicians deserve to be informed of the risks and benefits of their employment contract. Let Panacea Legal help you today at Panacea Legal. That is panacea.legal. This is attorney advertising. Prior results don't guarantee similar outcomes. Information provided is not legal advice and does not create an attorney-client relationship. This episode is brought to you by Grammarly. Folks, I'm not sure how it is for you, but for me, being able to maintain focus is one of the most important things in my workday, and it's hard for me to do. If I'm putting together a presentation, I might be getting email messages, and then I get a text message, and then I get a patient care message, and I have 37 browser tabs open. And it's easy for me to start to lose focus and start to lose time in that way. So focus is really important for me. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, you can stay focused and get through your work faster with relevant, real-time suggestions wherever you write. And you can download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. There's a lot of neat features with Grammarly, and now starting to use AI to help improve your writing. And one of the things that I especially like is it allows you to choose your tone. So I was actually working on some of the copy actually for this specific ad read and just kind of playing around with Grammarly, and it suggested I could choose a tone that was professional, persuasive, and witty. You know, just like I naturally am, but enhanced and double-checked by Grammarly. And it worked seamlessly. Like, I could use it within Microsoft Word, and you can use it throughout many apps and across multiple platforms. You can get more done without sacrificing the quality of the work that you do. Grammarly helps with any writing, from brainstorming to sounding more confident and persuasive at work. 90% of professionals say that Grammarly has saved them time writing and editing their work. 4 out of 5 professionals say Grammarly helps them gain buy-in and action through their communication. You can speed through the drafting and editing process while staying on task. Write and edit quickly with context-aware suggestions everywhere you write. Grammarly works across more than 500,000 apps and websites. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Get more done with Grammarly. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. I also want to ask about symptoms, just to be explicit, because again, I'm the dumb one on the show. But when you're talking about sort of the physical symptoms related to the nodules itself, are we talking like compressive symptoms? Are you asking about dysphagia or hoarseness? Yes. Is there anything else that you tend to assess when you're asking about those?
Thanks for asking more specifically. Yes, so the most common symptom that the patient reports in my personal experience in my clinic is neck tightness. So they just feel like there's something that is pressing on their neck and that's uncomfortable for them. If it's a large goiter, sometimes they can experience difficulty breathing when in reclined position. And as far as the dysphagia, yes, it's primarily with solids, and that's what makes helps you make the difference in terms of etiology, because solids and liquids, if they complain of both, it's most likely unrelated to the thyroid nodule. But I also have to say that the position of the nodule makes a huge difference, you know, because I'm sure you also saw a lot of patients with large thyroid nodules that have absolutely no symptoms, and that's because they're laterally positioned. So size in itself is not going to be enough to be causing symptoms definitively.
And I promise I'll let you move on to the case, but anytime that I'm talking to endocrinologists about thyroids, I have to ask about the examination. As a reminder, learning in medical school, where we're from behind, like we're stalking the patient and then theoretically having them drink from a soda straw, like it's just all very improbable. So I would love to hear actually from both you and Kanishka how your approach to the thyroid examination. Are we from the front? Are we using thumbs? Is that okay now? So what does your thyroid exam look like? I hope you don't mind me asking, Matt, but I'm going to ask every time.
No, it started through my training. It started like choking from behind. You know, that's basically how that's how we were trained as well. And before COVID, yes, we would give everybody the cup of water to swallow, and we would, you know, we would feel the thyroid moving with the swallowing. Unfortunately, with the COVID, that kind of fell. You know, we stopped doing that. So at this point, I have to say, I just started doing it again just today, basically, for the first time after 4 years. And that's strictly because I wanted to show the patient, hey, this is your thyroid, so put your finger there, let's swallow, and then you're gonna see what I'm talking about. But yes.
Oh, I bet they appreciated that. That's great.
Yeah, my only thing is that, so we can't feel things that are generally under a centimeter unless they're super, super superficial. So a lot of people get these small nodules that are found incidentally, and they're like, how come I can't feel it? But even with, if it's posterior, you might not actually even feel it up to like close to like 2 centimeters. And so, I mean, we do the exam from behind, as Anna mentioned, but I generally try to do one side at a time when I'm teaching my like residents and fellows. I'm like, don't press both. So use your fingertip and press one side, and then prep the patient so you don't scare them, right? And you're doing this exam, because most of all, you can do it from the front. So there's some endocrinologists that do it from the front too. You can actually do it from the front. So there are many different styles.
Yeah, someone told us they examine the thyroid from the front using their thumbs, and usually one side at a time. But yeah, okay, good question, Paul. I like that. I enjoyed that. Those answers.
I'm going to keep asking until I don't know what. But all right, we can move on.
There actually are studies. There was one specific study that looked to see what's the threshold size wise, where you know, and like Kanisha was saying, we miss 50% of thyroid nodules that are over 1 centimeter in size.
Yeah,
people look behind the, you know, under that.
This is good, Paul, because I've had a lot of patients like look at me with disappointment when they're like, why can't you feel my nodule? You know, so
you might be misreading why they're disappointed, Matt. I don't know.
I actually, before I listen to people's heart, I'm like, remind me, has anyone ever told you have heart murmurs? Because like, I just don't want them to be disappointed if I don't comment on a heart murmur that they know they have. Anyway, so that's a little pearl for the audience if you want to. I want to avoid that mess.
Well, more physical exam masterclass here. It's great.
Okay. So what we've talked about so far, we're asking about family history, radiation exposure, dysphagia for solids. Are they feeling tightness in their necks? That's not something that I would have thought to. So that I think that's a good tip. Are they having difficulty breathing? The subtle symptoms of hyperthyroidism could be personality changes, could be palpitations, could be heat intolerance. And you mentioned that the TSH, even if it was okay now, it can fluctuate if they have like a functioning nodule. Mm-hmm. So we need to think for that. And all of us now, there's a lot of ways to examine the thyroid. Just tell the patient you're going to be grabbing their neck and let them know that if it's a small nodule, we might not feel it. All right, Paul. So where are we going to next with this? Imaging, maybe, or?
Yeah. So I guess where from here, I suppose. So we happily, this patient has come to us, you know, ready made with a TSH result, which we talked about a little bit. But sort of what is the next step? Will we proceed right to thyroid ultrasound based on the TSH? When would we decide to do a radionuclide thyroid scan? Or how do you think about imaging or the next steps of workup for patients like this?
So yeah, before doing that, can I go back to and maybe make one more observation about the risk factors? And
sure.
That's yes. That's pertinent to basically, yeah, history of thyroid cancer. That's one thing, but the history of radiation, because I actually had patients. It's extremely rare, but every now and then I do ask anybody, I do ask everybody if they have any history of radiation, but the radiation in childhood actually is more important than in adulthood. And I did have a couple of patients who actually grew up and they were children in Ukraine at the mm-hmm. time of Chernobyl accident. And one out of two actually did end up having papillary thyroid cancer. So that's important to know. And it's important also that to note or to remember that whole body radiation in childhood, and then also whole body radiation for bone marrow transplant, that which can happen in both children and adults, has been associated with increased risk. So I just wanted to mention that. Now, when it comes to the imaging, really, so ultrasound is the gold standard. And if you have a thyroid nodule that's been just diagnosed and it did not have an ultrasound, I personally order an ultrasound in everybody. The old algorithm was saying, go out, check the TSH. If the TSH is suppressed, go to the move to the nuclear medicine scan. But I think in practice, nowadays, we all would recommend obtaining an ultrasound because there's much more information that you get from that. So that would be next. In terms of the nuclear medicine scan, I have to say, I do not order it as often as I used to when I started my endocrinology training and in the first years of practice. And I think, I was thinking about this recently. I think part of it is because in the past, we used to treat more of these toxic nodules and multinodular goiters with radioactive iodine. And I think the trend has changed over the past, several years. In the past, when you were treating with radioactive iodine, you needed to have an uptake, right, percentage, so you can calculate the dose. Most patients nowadays would prefer, if they are good candidates, would prefer to be on an antithyroidal medication, on metamizole, namely. And patients with toxic nodules and multinodular goiters do need this long term. So as soon as you try to back off the medication, they will become hyperthyroid again. However, they do need fairly low doses. So it appears less invasive, and it's more appealing to them, as opposed to going through the hypothyroidism, having to be on levothyroxine and so on and so forth. So I think that's the main reason we don't do the nuclear medicine scans as much. The other situation that we encounter, because we are primarily a consultative practice, we see patients that are not local. Sometimes a two-day test is not necessarily feasible for them. So unless it would change my management, I don't necessarily order it anymore. So for example, if I have, like I mentioned, somebody with a multinodular goiter, bilateral nodules, controlled on a low-dose metamizole, I wouldn't order it. But if you have a unilateral or if you suspect a unilateral toxic nodule in a patient who has local symptoms and you would consider it a lobectomy, then in that case, yes, it would make sense to do a scan and see, confirm that that is the overactive nodule and you know how to plan if an intervention of this sort is considered. But so that would be a scenario where I would order the nuclear medicines.
Yeah, you like Paul, that's something a test that I always thought like I'd be ordering more of, and you're right. Now that you mention it, I don't think I've ever ordered one. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Paul, is that your experience?
If I were paying attention to the boards, I'd be ordering them left and right, but you're right. It doesn't come mm-hmm. up in practicality as much as I thought that it would, like Theo's probably, which I thought I'd just be treating all the time, but yeah. It turns out not so much.
Yeah, I think it is primarily because the management has changed. And pretty much like the same with Graves' disease, and I know this is not the main topic, but the vast majority of patients these days would choose the antithyroidals over radioactive mm-hmm. iodine. So I can't tell you when was the last, I don't remember when is the last time I treated a Graves' disease with radioactive mm-hmm. iodine. Everybody would want to be on antithyroidal medication, and in the vast majority of cases, it is successful.
I do want to ask, this patient we gave you has a TSH of 0.86. We didn't give a free T4. Are there any other labs you would get for this patient that we presented, Ms. Tyrad, or Mr. Tyrad, rather? And then do people check calcitonin for this? That was something I was surprised to even hear about.
So, yeah, I like your question. because that takes me to a couple cases that I had where probably, so to answer your question, in this particular person, Probably not. I mean, with the information that we have. So the TSH is low normal. Usually, in order to, so TSH is far more sensitive than T4 and T3. So you would expect, in order for T4 and T3 to be abnormal, you would expect to see a TSH below normal. So with the TSH borderline, or in the lower half of the normal range, or close to the lower end of the normal range, it is most likely that T4 and T3 levels are going to be normal. Having said that, you can check the whole panel if you have any clinical, suspicion that this could be an overactive thyroid nodule. But by and large, I think it's going to be they will be normal. And I don't know, Kniksha can agree or disagree with me. But in terms of the calcitonin, so let me tell you about my two cases, okay? And then I guess we can go from there. But I had two patients with thyroid nodules. So each of them had a thyroid nodule that ended up undergoing a fine needle aspiration. And their report, the cytology report, came back with this a category 4, as in follicular neoplasm with oncocytic features or possibly oncocytic neoplasm. Our institution has FNA with reflux molecular testing. So we do save a sample at the time of the biopsy. And if it comes, if the cytology comes but as the category 3 or 4, we send it for molecular testing. So, and this is what we did in both these cases. And much to our surprise, the molecular testing came back medullary thyroid cancer. And that is because the oncocytes, or former Hertel cells, right, and the medullary or C cells where the medullary thyroid cancer originates from, can be very similar on cytology. And even experienced pathologists can actually be misled when they do the cytology. And I mean, when they read the slides. And so, if it wasn't for the molecular testing, right, we probably wouldn't have found out about this unless we proceeded with surgery, right? Because that's the way, the old way used to, that's the old way we used to do things, right? If it was indeterminate, or if it was in Bethesda 3 and 4, if you didn't have molecular testing available, then the final diagnosis was based on surgery, right? So now with the molecular testing, we get this additional stratification. But if, let's say, we didn't have reflex molecular testing and we had to bring the patient back to repeat the FNA and in order to get a sample for molecular testing, an alternative approach would have been measuring the calcitonin, knowing that the cytological diagnosis can be, I don't know, that the pathologist can misinterpret the C cells for.
Oh, interesting. And audience, we are going to get to the Bethesda classification and we'll go through that. So that's a little tease of what we're going to talk about in a minute here. Kniksha, did you have anything to say about that part of it?
So actually, I did want to talk about that, in that when you're ordering something, I think it's really important, two things to consider is the pretest probability of whether something is really going to be useful, and then cost. Like, it's not cheap to order a calcitonin level, and it's not cheap to order a free T4 level. So if it's going to change your management, definitely order it. But if you're kind of borderline, I would say there has to be a really good reason for me to order a calcitonin. Mm. Like, if there's a family history of thyroid cancer and multiple family members, I might consider it. Or, if they've had a FEO, I'm like, okay, so this might be MEN2, one of the genetic syndromes, I might order it. But generally, we don't order calcitonin level unless you're like very special. Like, if you get the molecular testing and then there's a RET positive, which I'm sure that's probably what the gene that came back was, then there's a good reason to order it. But otherwise, I would kind of shy away from, I'm a less is more kind of person.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah. You do want to know, you do want to know what to do with the result if you order a test. That's
and don't
true.
Forget, patients get a copy of the results. So you have to be pretty confident that it's actionable if it's abnormal, because no one likes an unactionable abnormal thing that you just keep testing.
Such
over
a good point.
On my
Such
tombstone.
Such a good point. On your tombstone, Paul. Well, okay. So let's briefly talk about the TIRADS, right? The American College of Radiology. I think it's, yeah, the American College of Radiology has this TIRADS, kind of like BI-RADS for breast cancer related to the thyroid ultrasound.
As far as much as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong. So TIRADS 1 is stone cold normal. 2 is benign. 3 is probably benign. 4A is low suspicion. 4B is high suspicion. And 5 is bad business, probably malignant. Mm-hmm. Is that a yes. fair summary to say? Could I ask you, and we'll have the reports and those will be helpful to the specific question, but going back to our patient, so we have someone who's got, to me, what sounds like a pretty big nodule that is described as either solid or almost completely solid. I guess my question for you are, what are the characteristics on a report other than the TIRADS criteria that should raise our eyebrows or make us nervous that we're dealing with something scary? Are there certain characteristics or features that that we should read as particularly worrisome? I recognize that we'll have probably a categorization or recommendation from the read as well.
Well, I mean, the TIRADS do include those characteristics by and large, because you're looking at the shape of the nodule, you're looking at whether the margins are irregular or not, you're looking at whether there are some calcifications or microcalcifications. So all those features that we would normally look in a thyroid nodule are basically included in the TIRADS. So I think by and large, most of the nodules that we see, whether they are, imaged in-house or come from elsewhere, are classified based on the TIRADS or an equivalent. But that is, so all those ultrasound features, all those morphological characteristics are included in the TIRADS.
I think when you're looking at it, also one really bad feature is actually if there's abnormal lymph nodes. So this is outside of the nodule, but this is like cancer until proven otherwise. So if your radiologist is like, all these abnormal lymph nodes exist, yes, there's a chance that they might be reactive, but definitely biopsy those. And I know we kind of talked about endocrinologists would love to see all of your patients and biopsy the nodules, but our wait times are kind of long sometimes. So if the patient's having a lot of anxiety about waiting a couple months to see us, obviously waiting a couple months for like 99% of patients is not going to change the outcome. I really want to empower primary care doctors to really go ahead and biopsy that while you're waiting. Schedule the visit, biopsy it. And then we have something else to talk about when we see the patient too. Like we can go over the biopsy results as well. Like, so if the patient's really, I want something sooner than later, go ahead and do it. I mean, we do our own biopsies. Anna and I do our own biopsies, and we would love to do the biopsies, but we obviously can't see even all the endocrinology stuff. They couldn't just see all the right nodules that exist because it's so common.
And on that note, I also wanted to mention, Kaniksha brought up a good point with respect to the cervical lymph nodes, but I want to make an observation on that. So not all the ultrasound studies that I personally see coming from, other facilities include the lymph nodes. So some of them are strictly limited to the thyroid. So and sometimes it just has to do with the way the order is written. So for example, when you issue an order for a thyroid ultrasound, you may want to say, please include cervical lymph nodes. And in that case, they will specifically, add that imaging in. But it really, the protocols vary a whole lot from institution to institution. So sometimes you just need, all it needs to be done is to specify that in the order in order to get the whole, the complete imaging.
And before we get to the next part of the case, the other thing I just wanted to ask, and because this comes up all the time too, like if someone's had ultrasounds, maybe they've had a biopsy that was benign, and they like, at what point can we just stop ultrasounding them or stop worrying about this thing?
Yeah. So I'm hoping that the, American Thyroid Association is supposed to come out with guidelines, and they were supposed to come out this year, but it's most likely going to be 2025. So at this point, we don't have definitive guidelines. I think through the TIRADS, through the American Association of Radiology, there are some guidelines in a sense that if a nodule has not changed after 5 years, you can stop. But I have to say, so if it was benign and it and it didn't change subsequently, you don't have to follow up beyond 5 years. But I have a problem convincing the patients of that, especially if they are younger.
It sounds like you're in the same boat as Paul and I, where like the person's just like, if they want the ultrasound, they're just getting multiple, they've had like 10 thyroid ultrasounds, and you know, it's just, they're like, okay, it's still the same as it was.
So what I tend to do, I do lengthen the follow-up interval, and do tell them, I do tell them, okay, if it's the same next time, then the following time is going to be 3 years or 5 years. And then eventually I do say, you know, at this point we get to where this can be followed on a clinical basis, and only if you experience any local symptoms, or you don't need another ultrasound unless you experience any local symptoms.
This episode is brought to you by Babbel. Are you planning any exciting trips this year? I bet something you might not be planning is learning the local language. Well, with Babbel, you only need a few weeks to learn. This year, speak like a whole new you with Babbel, the language learning app that gets you talking. Learning a new language is the pathway to discovering new cultures, so why not embark on learning something new? Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to get you to begin speaking your new language in 3 weeks or whatever pace you choose. And because conversing is the key to really understanding each other in a new language, Babbel is designed using practical, real-world conversations. Spending months with private teachers is the old way of learning languages, and nothing screams tourist like holding a phone translation app up to your face all day. Babbel's tips and tools are inspired by the real-life stuff you actually need when communicating. With a focus on conversation, you'll be ready to talk wherever you go. I would like to go to France this year, and I fully intend to, and I would like to be able to order a croissant and perhaps ask for the touristy stuff is without experiencing too much disdain. And so I hope to use Babbel to learn just enough French to not be ashamed the entire time. Do you need proof that Babbel gets you talking? Studies from Yale, Michigan State, and other leading universities continue to prove that Babbel works. One study found that Babbel, used for 15 hours, is equivalent to a full semester at college. With over 16 million subscriptions sold, Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. This year, get talking with Babbel. Let's get more of you talking in a new language. Babbel is gifting our listeners 60% off subscriptions at babbel.com/curb. That's get up to 60% off at babbel.com/curb, spelled BABBEL.com/curb. Babbel.com/curb. Rules and restrictions may apply. Okay, so we're at the part where we're proceeding with the fine needle aspiration for Mr. Rad.
Mm-hmm.
Of his large, I'll stop calling him large, I suppose, but of his thyroid nodules. The biopsy results in this situation come back as benign, so he's Bethesda class 2. So it's sort of branching out from this conversation, you would just sort of a quick breakdown of the Bethesda categories and sort of how they dictate what further management looks like.
Yeah, so you have category 1, which is non-diagnostic. So essentially the pathologist was not able to give you a result based on the sample that they had to analyze. The Bethesda category 2 is benign. So those are the benign thyroid nodules. Fine needle aspirations are a very high accuracy. So it's extremely unlikely that a nodule that's categorized Bethesda 2 is going to turn out to be malignant at the end. It's about 2% risk for malignancy, you know, excluding NIFP. Bethesda 3 is atypia of unknown significance. Bethesda 4 is follicular neoplasm or follicular neoplasm of oncocytic type. And then 5 is suspicious for malignancy and 6 is malignant. I believe your question was about Bethesda category 2, right? So the benign thyroid nodule. So if we get that type of result on a patient, I usually tell them that I recommend an ultrasound in 1 to 2 years. I know that some say 6 to 12 months, but it is a little bit on a case-by-case basis, but mm-hmm. if we do the biopsy, we're comfortable with the needle placement, we're comfortable with, the pathology reading. And so there's, it's less likely, it's quite unlikely that this would not be accurate than most patients are fine with a repeat ultrasound in 1 to 2 years.
Okay, so basically, you just to recap, so one is non-diagnostic, so we're kind of stuck there. Two is benign, and then you said three is this undetermined atypia of unknown significance.
Yeah.
Unknown significance. Four is follicular. Five is suspicious for malignancy, and six is malignant. Mm-hmm. And basically, the category three and four, from my reading, are the kind of the indeterminate ones where
right.
And that was the case you were given the example of before, where you said it reflexes to like a molecular
mm-hmm.
test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So before the molecular testing was developed, so like as when I was a fellow, for example, or a little bit before then. Okay. So the way I'm explaining this to the patients is the following.
Oh, this is great.
So I'm drawing the thyroid, and then I drew a circle, which is the nodule. And I tell them that the difference between benign and malignant in the three and four categories is given by the status of the nodule, the capsule of the nodule. So if the capsule is basically invaded or penetrated with cells, then that makes it cancer. If the capsule is intact, then that means it's a benign adenoma. When we poke the nodule with the needle, we don't get any information on the status of the capsule. And the pathologist in these particular categories cannot tell benign versus malignant based on the way the cells look like. That's what I tell them. And so before we had the molecular testing, and before the molecular testing was, you know, the performance of the molecular testing improved to, you know, to today's, the only modality to get a definitive diagnosis was to do a lobectomy, do frozen sections. The pathologist would section the capsule, look under the microscope, and see how the capsule looked like. Now we have the molecular testing, so we don't need to do this. We don't need to do the surgery beforehand. The molecular testing, there are a few, you know, options out there. But in a nutshell, it's looking for mutations or for genetic abnormalities that are typically seen in a cancerous nodule and they're not seen in a benign one. And that's basically how you get an additional result in terms of what's the potential risk of malignancy in a nodule. And this can go anywhere from under 3% to greater than 70%. So depending on which test you're looking at. But that's kind of how I describe it.
Wow. So that's like a major change that, like, because I don't remember learning about the molecular testing at all. Until I was reading this, because like I'm sending people endocrinology and largely I'm not knowing what's happening like on the back end of things too much. I don't know about you, Paul, but that's how I feel. So I think we should move on to the next case. So let's say
I do want to make like one comment about the molecular
sure.
testing. Mm-hmm. The molecular testing does not tell us if it's cancer. I just want to clarify. Mm-hmm. It downgrades the risk of it being cancer if it's not cancer. So those are the nodules that we can follow. But if your molecular testing is positive, we have to take it out to see if mm-hmm. it's cancer or not. And there's a good chance it still might not be cancer. What I was saying is that it can range. Like sometimes it's a 50% risk. Sometimes it's a 75% risk. It can provide a risk, but it cannot tell you definitively that it's cancer.
Yeah, so we'll definitely have the endocrinologist involved if we're messing with molecular testing and everything. But that's good to know that it's available now and it's helping to risk stratify people. Before we move on to talking about cancer, Kinixia, in your section, I did see that for some nodules, sometimes there are some newer treatments like injectable things you can do or burny things you can do to nodules. So Anna, did you want to talk a little bit about that? And maybe Kinixia can fill in any other gaps?
So yeah, this is a great point. And indeed, we don't talk about it too often because it's fairly new on the in the United States, although it has been minimally invasive treatments for thyroid nodules have been practiced in Europe. Italy is at the forefront there. But these are modalities that would avoid surgical interventions for benign symptomatic thyroid nodules primarily. So there are a couple, there are basically two categories. If you're talking about treating a large asymptomatic thyroid cyst, so completely fluid filled, then this is something that we have been doing as well. And that's alcohol sclerosis of that particular cyst. And so you basically aspirate the cyst and then re-inject pure alcohol along with a little bit of the cyst fluid. The idea is to create a scar, you know, inside the walls, the cyst walls, and prevent that fluid from cystic fluid from reaccumulating. And that's because when you aspirate large cysts, they very often just come back. That's what it is. So by injecting alcohol, you try to prevent that from happening. For solid nodules, there are two treatment options. There's laser ablation and radiofrequency ablation. And the approach basically differs with the institution, but the idea is the same. So basically, you apply laser or you apply a current within a large nodule with the intent to shrink that. So you create a scar. It gets initially larger as a result of inflammation, but then it gets smaller over the next following months. There are some pros and cons for each of them. You know, it's practiced by surgeons, interventional radiologists, and some endocrinologists. So different types of specialties can actually do this. And again, the biggest advantage is that the people get to keep their thyroids, right? One prerequisite is to have two benign biopsies prior to this. So you want to make sure that what you're treating is truly a benign nodule, because once you applied that particular procedure, current or laser, the architecture of those cells changes, and it's very difficult to make an interpretation of a biopsy afterwards. One more thing I wanted to mention, if it came to, since we're talking about this, some institutions actually do radio frequency ablation for small biopsy proven papillary thyroid cancer. So this is an upcoming method, and we don't have long-term follow-up on that, but so far, you know, the recent data suggests that you can successfully destroy very small, typically less than 1 centimeter papillary thyroid cancers confined to the thyroid. So there are some criteria to to select those candidates, but that again, it's something that's newly has been happening recently.
Yeah, so I do want to make a plug that endocrinologists do this procedure. It's an outpatient procedure. That's the great thing about it, is that there's no anesthesia. It's a completely outpatient procedure. The recovery time is a little bit longer than, it's a short recovery time overall, but if you're shrinking a nodule, obviously taking it out, it makes it go away, the shrinking immediately, right? So there's the length in that aspect, but it is pretty well tolerated. It's completely outpatient. And then the only other thing that I was going to add is that you can use it for toxic adenomas as well. And you can radiate the nodule so that the patient's actually euthyroid afterwards. And so you don't have to worry about hypothyroidism with radioactive iodide or with surgery when you remove the nodule.
All right. Let's move on to our next case. So we'll talk about Ms. Theoglobulin. We'll make her even Theodora. Just for consistency's sake, she is a 62-year-old female. She has a history of COPD and hyperlipidemia. She presented initially due to a painless right anterior neck swelling of uncertain duration. On exam, she had a palpable enlargement of the right lobe of her thyroid, and we even thought that her trachea was slightly displaced to the left. An ultrasound showed two solid nodules on the right side, the first being 3.7 centimeters and the second being 3.4 in the maximal dimensions. Fine needle aspiration was performed, and this demonstrated atypia of undetermined significance, which is Bethesda Category 3. On shared decision-making between the patient and the surgeon, the patient decided to undergo right lobectomy with isthmostectomy, which I said as fast as I could because I knew I was going to mispronounce it. Surgical pathology was consistent with a papillary carcinoma confined to the thyroid gland, and the patient was subsequently brought back to the OR 2 months later for a complete thyroidectomy. So Before we dig into sort of how we manage her from here and sort of the specific details of the case, can you just give us the broad overview of the subcategories of the thyroid cancer and how they're different? I feel like we all learn these at some point, and it's so easy for me at least to kind of forget about the nuanced differences. So can you talk us through them, please?
Sure. Okay. So I just wanted to start with, when people think of thyroid cancer, there's this idea out there that it's a good cancer. I just want to debunk that. There is no good cancer. So for anybody who says that, don't ever say that. Everybody's journey is a little bit different. Thyroid cancer does, in general, have a very excellent prognosis, but they're very different types, right? So I wanted to kind of, when we're thinking about thyroid cancer, I kind of think of it as in three buckets. So the first bucket is well-differentiated thyroid cancer. The second bucket is the C-cell medullary one. And the third bucket is anaplastic. And the way that we differentiate those is based on the type of cell. So for differentiated, it's going to be follicular. For the medullary, it's a C-cell. And then we're going to see, is it look like a thyroid cell? So is it differentiated, or is it more like it's mutated into some other thing that's unrecognizable? And that's what puts it in the anaplastic category. So for the differentiated one, traditionally, most people just learned about two, right? Papillary and follicular. There's actually a third type that got reclassified by the WHO recently. And in 2022, there was a subtype of follicular known as Hürthel cell. And that got reclassified as its own third category under differentiated, now under oncocytic. So each of those three things, even though they're in the broader group of well-differentiated, they do have slightly different pathophysiology, and they have slightly different outcomes because of that. So the papillary is what people think of as the good cancer that a lot of people think of. That's the one that has a five-year survival rate of like 99%. So that one is actually spread through the lymph nodes. The majority of patients, it is confined to the thyroid gland on presentation, but about 20 to 30% of people, it can actually go to the lymph nodes at the time of presentation. So that's kind of why we get our ultrasound to make sure that it hasn't spread, right? We want a really good ultrasound of those lymph nodes to make sure it hasn't spread, because it changes our management. So as I said earlier, I'm a less is more kind of girl. And actually, the ATA has kind of swung the pendulum a little bit on how much treatment these patients need. So thyroid cancer patients, traditionally, everybody got a total thyroidectomy, everybody got radioactive iodine, and everybody got lots of thyroid hormone. So those days left. Those days are gone about 15 years ago. We stopped doing that. So now we have a hemithyroidectomy as a main treatment option. Which we just take out half the thyroid gland. And we do radioactive iodine only in intermediate to higher risk patients. And we don't do as much levothyroxine suppression therapy. And I think that's going to be kind of important as we talk about the treatment for this patient later. So for the papillary, we have a option of surgery as the primary treatment. And then followed by, if it's higher risk, we'll do radioactive iodine. And that's very similar to how follicular works as well. But the difference is that follicular tends to metastasize more through the bloodstream. And so you can get these distant mets to the bones. And so it has a slightly worse prognosis than papillary does, but they kind of get grouped together in the way that they're researched currently. But it does have a slightly worse prognosis than papillary. And papillary is about 80% of differentiated, and follicular ends up being about 10 to 15%. And then oncocytic is rarer. It's about 2 to 3% of well-differentiated thyroid cancers. And it, depending on the mutation, which Anna has done research in this, it can be really worse prognosis, or some of the mutational actually make it a little bit more towards a prognosis of like papillary and follicular thyroid cancer. So not everybody who has oncocytic is it going to be bad in, but if you have certain mutations, like TERT mutation, it could be considerably worse. Okay, so those are the well-differentiated, so those three. Then there's this category, medullary. So everybody's probably heard of medullary because it's on your boards. It's associated with MEN2. So this is that genetic condition where you can have a pheochromocytoma with the thyroid cancer. And this is caused by a majority of them are caused by RET mutations that tend to run in families if it tends to be in a germline mutation. And the treatment for this is actually surgery. And depending on the mutation, it might even be surgery and testing in your children. So when you get the genetic testing, is there's a genetic counselor that recommends what kind of screening is associated with your family and what kind of treatment moves forward based on the specific gene in the RET mutation that you have. And there is no radioactive iodine treatment for medullary. So because it works on C cells and not the follicular cells, the radioactive iodine doesn't work in this group of patients. And comparatively to the differentiated one, we use normal TSH. There's no levothyroxine suppression. And then the last group, which is the really, really bad thyroid cancer, which actually bad cancer in general, comparatively to most cancers, is probably one that has like the worst prognosis out there, which is anaplastic thyroid cancer. It's the most aggressive type. It's the one that we all get scared about because the patient wakes up with a huge expanding neck mass overnight and they can literally choke to death within like a week or two, if you, depending on where we catch it in the cycle. Like it's not great. So everybody in that category is actually stage four on presentation. And a five-year life expectancy is pretty poor. It's like less than 10%. So we have been making strides on improving the outcomes in these patients based on recent testing. If they have a BRAF mutation, there's some new adjuvant chemotherapy that we can use to kind of shrink the tumor prior to resection. But it's we have a long way to go in that category. And the treatment for that is actually surgery if you catch it early enough that you can actually surgically resect it. And then external beam radiation. So we don't use radioactive iodine in anaplastic, and we don't use TSH suppression in anaplastic because those two also don't work in anaplastic. So those are kind of the main overview of thyroid cancer, I would say. When you're staging thyroid cancer, it comes in the classic four stages of other cancers. But interestingly, it's actually, for the well-differentiated one, it's actually staged based on age. So for the PTC, FTC, and the oncocytic, if you're under the age of 55, you can only have a stage one or stage two. And stage one is anywhere in the neck, and stage two is like distant metastatic disease. And the reason for that is even if you have distant metastatic disease, if you're young, your prognosis, like these are treatable things, and your five-year and 10-year survival is still pretty good. It's not what's traditionally associated with the stage for like breast cancer or colon cancer. So they try to restage it based on that. And then the same thing with anaplastic, because it's so terrible, everybody is a stage four in presentation. So there's a little bit differencing in staging for thyroid cancer than is for other cancers. The other thing that we look at is that the ATA has these kind of risk stratification. So we're looking at if you're under 55 and you have a lot of neck disease for your papillary thyroid cancer, your prognosis might still be okay as far as mortality and morbidity. But what is the risk of the cancer recurring after the primary treatment that we choose to do? So we put it in three buckets in this low risk, which is the cancer coming back is usually like less than 5%, somewhere between 1% and 2%. Intermediate risk, which can be anywhere from like 10 to like 30%. And high risk, which is usually associated over 50%, 40 to 50% risk of cancer is coming back. And that really helps us define what we want to do for our primary treatment. So the more the risk of the cancer coming back, the more treatment we're going to do in the beginning. So if it's high risk, we're going to do a total thyroidectomy. If it's high risk, we're going to do radioactive iodine. And if it's high risk, we're going to do extra thyroid hormone for suppression, at least in the beginning. As opposed to if it's low risk, we're going to back off on doing all of those things because of the risk of complications from all of the treatment options that we have. So I know that's a lot of information to take in.
The risk that you were just talking about, is that mainly for the well-differentiated types, like the medullary thyroid, the anaplastic? Those are probably automatically?
Those are separate.
Separate. Okay. So for well-differentiated, how are you determining what's like low risk, intermediate, or high risk? Is it is based on the size and the lymph nodes and what factors in there?
Combination of all of those things. So it's based on the final pathology. So its size is one thing. Generally, if you have a larger cancer, it can be more intermediate risk. Size alone isn't going to make it high risk, though. Mm-hmm. There are variants of papillary thyroid cancer that make it a little bit more high risk of recurrence. So these are things that you might see in the endocrinologist notes, this tall cell variant or hobnail variant or columnar variant. So it's not classic PTC in the PAP report. So those things tend to keep coming back because they're not how traditionally papillary thyroid cancer goes. And then the more lymph nodes that you have, the higher risk of it recurring is, because the less chance that we have of like kind of getting it all out in the beginning when we do the treatment. That is one of the reasons why we use the radioactive iodine, is to like, those are kind of the patients that have the most data on preventing morbidity and mortality from thyroid cancer, is those higher risk patients. But if you have a lot of lymph nodes and they're really big lymph nodes, then that makes you high risk. And then anybody who has distant metastatic disease to the lungs or the bones, automatically they're going to be high risk. And those are, the radioactive iodine works really well in the lungs, not so much in the bones, but some patients do still get good treatment with radioactive iodine to the bones too. It's we get scans and we see where the treatment went.
Paul, what do you want to know about this as America's primary care physician?
I guess I would like to know what they think that I should know. So I think oftentimes we see patients with a history of thyroid cancer, and I'm always, and they've sort of lost touch with their endocrinologists, and I'm not quite sure what our TSH goal should be or how aggressive I should be doing with, like, should I be doing surveillance ultrasounds? Like, where do I go from here? And what is sort of typical follow-up if someone has not seen endocrinology for a while, for someone who's had a history of cancer, or is it totally dependent on the type of cancer that they had?
So partly it depends the type of cancer that they have.
Oh, that's not what I was hoping to hear, but okay, carry on.
Okay, so most of the patients actually are low risk and excellent prognosis. So the higher risk ones generally will tell you that my endocrinologist says that I have to keep seeing them forever. So there's a little bit of onus on the patient as well, right? So they tell you a little bit of history about their cancer, and I try to educate my patients on, you know, this is the type of thyroid cancer you had, the papillary, the follicular, what kind of treatments they should know if they've had like total thyroidectomy or radioactive iodine. And ideally they would be, at least in the beginning, followed for at least a short period of time to see what kind of response to treatment they've had, right? So assuming that they're low risk and they've had an excellent response to treatment, current recommendations are to get an annual thyroglobulin level. So that's once a year. Once a year, we're getting a TSH to make sure their dose of thyroid hormone doesn't need to be adjusted as they age or as they gain or lose weight or as they change medications. These are all reasons to adjust it. And then periodic neck ultrasound. So it's kind of the guidelines are kind of vague on, like, is this going to be 1 year? Is this going to be 2 years? Is this going to be 5 years? We are working on newer guidelines to kind of differentiate that. And when can we stop monitoring? That's a good question as well. For our current guidelines, we don't stop monitoring, but I think the newer ones are going to give a little bit more definitive, like, here's when we can stop monitoring. After 5 years, if they've had excellent response to treatment, you can probably skip the ultrasounds at some point. So what I do in my own practice is that initially in the first couple of years, I get more frequent ultrasounds, usually 6 to 12 months. And then as time goes on, I kind of space them out. Of course, it depends on the patient's anxiety level, how comfortable they are with just that thyroglobulin screening. Is the thyroglobulin able to be a good screening marker for that patient? And those kind of factors come into play, whether I get more ultrasounds or less ultrasounds. And actually with COVID, a lot of people, we, believe it or not, we've had to postpone our ultrasounds because they, you know, couldn't come in, or they have a cold and now they're not allowed to get an ultrasound anymore. Or, you know, there, people went years without getting ultrasounds, and they actually did fine. The main thing is that you're getting the TSH regularly for the dose of the thyroid hormone, and that you're getting the thyroglobulin ideally once like a year, just to do it as a screening.
Kanikshya, with some people getting hemithyroidectomies now, are many of those patients still needing replacement therapy?
Yeah, so this is a good question. So when we started with the hemithyroidectomies, we had an ideal TSH goal of 0.5 to 2.0. So we were trying to make them in the bottom half of normal. But what we found out is that traditionally, if you take out one lobe, about 80% of people actually don't need any sort of thyroid hormone replacement. So it's like having one kidney versus two kidneys. Yes, you are at slightly higher risk of getting CKD, but that doesn't mean you're going to get it. So most people actually didn't. And then when we put this TSH goal of 0.5 to 2.0, now we're actually on the opposite, like 60 to 80% actually require thyroid hormone. So the goal of doing the hemi, one of the goals of doing the hemithyroidectomy is that you didn't have to take lifelong thyroid hormone replacement. But when we started doing less is more, we didn't have a lot of data to say, is this actually okay? But now that we've been doing it for a decade, we have a lot more data. And we're going to actually change that recommendation on one of the upcoming guidelines and say that, hey, if you should just keep the TSH goal normal rather than trying to make it 0.5 to 2.0. So if they're normal and they're not hypothyroid, no, you don't have to start thyroid hormone replacement. That's what I do in my practice. I have a conversation with the patient. Some people feel very symptomatic if their TSH is like 3. And those are the people that you're going to give thyroid hormone replacement to. Whether or not it works, placebo effect, I don't know. But those are the people that you're going to give the thyroid hormone replacement to anyway. But if I have a bunch of patients who are totally adamant that I don't want to take extra hormone, and this is why I did hemithyroidectomy, and I can't remember to take the medication, and I'm like, okay, if your TSH is like 2.5, 3.2, you're actually probably statistically going to be fine. We didn't have the data for a long time, but now we have more data and we're like, okay, actually they are fine. So we don't necessarily need to do that extra step. So there'll be more coming out on that, but not everybody who gets a hemithyroidectomy will need thyroid hormone. Mm.
And of course, if we do relax the TSH goal, we'll be checking the annual TSH, the thyroglobulin, the periodic neck ultrasound. So hopefully if things start to go awry, we would pick up on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If the patient wants to be seen by an endocrinologist, just send them back anytime.
Except for if you have a lobectomy, so a patient treated with a hemithyroidectomy, the thyroglobulin is not really useful in that case because it's going to be detectable, because of the remaining lobe. So at the beginning, we used to measure that, at least in our practice. We kind of gave up on. At the beginning, we wanted to see if we can make anything out of the result, but it really additional data came out and it's not really useful. So really that we don't typically measure that in patients treated with just hemithyroidectomy. Mm-hmm.
But the hemithyroidectomy ideally would be chosen because they're very low risk, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So if you chose properly for a patient to get a hemithyroidectomy, then you wouldn't necessarily need all of this monitoring as well.
Okay. Paul, any other questions about monitoring? I know we're towards the end and I want to talk about GLP-1s, but any other questions?
I think we've hit my high points.
Okay.
And I do want to save time for the GLP-1 question because it's going to come up more and more frequently.
Go ahead. Ask away. I'll let you do the honors.
Yeah. So the question is, so what do we do with this? So I feel like with the GLP-1s, there was this theoretical concern for increased risk of thyroid cancer when you're screening for family history and personal history. And yes, have you ever had, when you're feeling with men type 2 syndrome and the patients look at you like you had two heads because no one's actually ever heard what that is. So I guess, what does the data show us right now? How concerned should we be? Should we be screening all patients that we start on these agents? Like, what is the current thinking among our endocrinologic experts about the risk of thyroid cancer, specifically with the GLP-1 agonists now that everyone is on them?
Yeah, so I think a lot has changed in like the last 20 years about how we feel about this. So GLP-1 agonists have been around for almost 20 years. So they were initially treated just for plain diabetes. And then nobody cared other than if you had medullary, yep, but it was an endocrinologist who would usually be more bothered than primary care, right? Whether you're going to start this medication or not for diabetes, because it was like kind of clear cut. And then we started using semaglutide, which is a higher dose of the medication that can cause that promotes weight loss, as opposed to just diabetes management. And then all this data started coming out about whether there's this increased theoretical risk of thyroid cancer. And in 2023, there was a French study that came out that was looking back on it, that they did a retrospective review of diabetics, and they didn't really account for a lot of control factors, but they did find a slightly higher risk of thyroid cancer. Since then, we've had multiple other studies that have come out that say, no, it's not as high as we initially thought. But I think the main thing is that we also have to weigh the risks and benefits of the obesity treatment, because obesity itself causes diabetes, it causes hypertension, it causes arthritis, it causes a lot of comorbid conditions. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. I don't think we have like years, we don't have decades of data as far as using it for weight loss medications, because the dose is a little bit more for the weight loss medications. That being said, statistically speaking, they probably had papillary thyroid cancer, well-differentiated thyroid cancer, because if they had a remote history, it's very rare to have a remote history of anaplastic. So you can take that, scratch that off. Medullary, most people have multiple family members with medullary, and most people will know that they have medullary. I feel like we really hone that into the patients if they have medullary. So if they have a remote one family member that may have had thyroid cancer, you could ask, you know, did you get a hemithyroid? Well, if it's very remote, you could actually ask if they got radioactive iodine. So if the answer is, yeah, I knew my family member got radioactive iodine, then there's zero chance it was medullary. So that quickly takes it off the table. If they were on extra suppressive thyroid hormone, also should take it off the table, because endocrinologists don't give excess thyroid hormone for medullary thyroid cancer. If the patient's having severe anxiety about their family history, then yeah, don't use it. But I don't think that otherwise it would have, just having one person with a remote family history of thyroid cancer would have necessarily stopped me from using a GLP-1 agonist in a patient.
Paul, that's just such a smart way that we can now try to narrow down like what type of thyroid cancer was in the family. You gave us a lot of clues there. It's really good.
Yeah. And with medullary, multiple family members have it too. So I'd be more suspicious than if it was like one aunt somewhere here, as opposed to my mom, dad, brother, and sister all had thyroid cancer, but I didn't know exactly what it was, right? Mm-hmm. Then you'd be a little more, okay, that's too many people to be having thyroid cancer for it to not be some sort of familial gene mutation. So I think just diving a little bit more into the history sometimes helps with that. And honestly, there are some people out there who are actually still even looking at GLP-1 use in medullary. So you will see some case reports and some studies coming out about that in like the next couple of years as well. So I know it's contraindicated currently, and I personally don't use it in my medullary patients, but there might be some data coming out on that as well in the future.
I think you also have to keep in mind that medullary is quite rare compared to the differentiated, compared to papillary. It's about 3%, you know, of all thyroid cancers, so the likelihood of coming across these, it's quite small. Mm-hmm. And then the other question that we get in practice, for example, is like, should we get an ultrasound? Should we look for thyroid nodules in anybody who intends to go on a GLP-1? And at this point, at least to my knowledge, there's no such recommendation in terms of screening.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I personally do not screen unless I have a very good reason to screen, right? Because you will find like over the age of 50, 50% of people have thyroid nodules. And
right.
You're going to be on the rabbit hole of, oh my God, now I have this other problem that I found in my patient. Now I have to biopsy it. Now I have to do this. Now I have to do that. And then like 2 years later, you're down the line and finally start the GLP-1, right? Hmm. So I would say, you know, I don't get ultrasounds in these patients. Our guidelines don't recommend getting ultrasounds currently. Something might change in the future, but currently there's no recommendations for getting ultrasounds in these patients. Now, if you do a neck exam and you feel a lump, then yeah, sure, get an ultrasound, right? But assuming that your physical exam is normal, no, I wouldn't get it.
You know, it's funny, Matt, because I don't feel like I've been doing this a long time. Like in my heart, I still identify as an early career physician. But I remember the days of fighting the fight to get daily exenatide for a patient and feeling like I was a cutting edge genius. And now that is a medication that seems just quaint and bygone and from a different era. So I've forgotten how long the GLP-1 agonists have been around, but at least as long since I was in training.
Yeah, I was in training too. And that was, I think, the only one. And liraglutide came on towards the end of,
So Kanikshya, is it fair to say if a patient had a hemithyroidectomy for papillary thyroid cancer, and they weighed 300 pounds and they wanted to take semaglutide or tirzepatide for weight loss, and we've gotten them through their cancer, it would be reasonable to use it. They don't have medullary thyroid cancer or anaplastic, then it would be okay to use?
Yeah, I use it in my cancer. I treat a lot of thyroid cancer, and we use it regularly in our thyroid cancer.
Okay. That's that's good to know, because it will come up. I'm sure it will come up for people in the audience.
Yeah, you guys are different. Like, those are two different pathophysiologies, right? Like, if you had cancer, and is it going to cause a recurrence, versus if you never had cancer, is it going to cause cancer in the first place? And I think we have more data on that. If you never had cancer, is it going to cause cancer? Which I don't think it's a super increased risk. I don't think it's statistically significant enough for me to currently change practice. I think there's even less data on the recurrence, but we do use it in a lot of our thyroid cancer patients, because, as you may know, thyroidectomy patients, for some reason, tend to gain weight more than the normal population. So we do use it frequently in our patients as well.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I learned so much from this talk. Thank you to both of you. So, Anna, we'll start with you. If you could give the audience like one or two take-home points you want them to remember about thyroid nodules.
Most of them are benign. So I think the take-home point number one is that you can probably reassure the patients in the vast majority of cases. Number two take-home point would be, I have to think a little bit. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, we can go to Kanikshya if you want to give us some take-home points on thyroid cancer.
Sure. I covered this before. There's no good cancer. So every patient's journey is different. And I think it's important to meet them where they are in the journey. There'll be some patients with more anxiety than others. And it's really important to acknowledge that. For the patient's sake and for your sake, please acknowledge that, and don't kind of brush them off. Again, cancer is not a great thing to have. So that's my first tip. My second tip is that, you know, the current paradigm in thyroid cancer is really considering what the long-term side effects of treatment, such as total thyroidectomy, radioactive iodine, TSH suppression, what are these risks years out from treatment? And so we've actually had a shift in how we manage these patients in the less is more category. So we do more heavy thyroidectomies, we do less radioactive iodine treatment, and we do less TSH suppression. And then the third tip that I had is that the GLP agonists use. So I think you really need to consider the bigger picture regarding obesity and comorbid conditions. Do they have diabetes, hypertension, arthritis? Will the weight loss get them off these medications and generally improve their quality and quantity of life? So I think those are kind of important things to consider.
Okay, fantastic. Anna, unless you thought of anything else, I think we can end there. You gave us so much already.
Well, I think from everything that we discussed, this would be, so that would be the main thing, that they are common and the vast majority of them are benign. So we can reassure the patients of that. The second point would be that the ultrasound is the gold standard. So it's, in most cases, it's going to tell you what to do with that particular thyroid nodule, whether you can stop there and just monitor versus proceed further with further intervention. I don't know. I think the third point would be related to the molecular testing. So really being aware that that is an option that will reduce the number of surgical interventions. So it can be used or it should be used, and the primary care physicians can order it as well in addition to the biopsy.
All right. And I wanted to just remind everybody that we have to thank the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology for hooking us up with two great guests for this episode. Check out their website, their guidelines. They do great work there. And with that, we will go to our outro.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
You're still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com, and while you're there, sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Elise Burke. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Manchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.